Good evening and welcome to the Royal Albert Hall for what should be an astonishing evening. The stage is set with no fewer than six choirs and two orchestras, including the BBC National Orchestra of Wales. And that's not counting the rock band and any number of soloists for the first ever Proms performance of Leonard Bernstein's theatre piece, Mass. The average age on stage has got to be well under 20. This is the best example yet of the way youth is taking this Proms season by storm. Four of the choirs tonight are from Welsh primary schools, and believe me, they are in fine voice. Marshalling the troops is conductor Christian Jervi. He loves Bernstein's Mass, he's recorded it to great acclaim, and has spent the last week working with a whole host of musical talent in Wales.
It is such an incredible mixture of ages and people of all backgrounds. We've had a wonderful period with all of these incredible kids. I've never seen so many kids singing in a choir together. We've had so many great moments, you know, where people are totally laughing and in such enjoyment of the music.
Enjoyable, yes, but Bernstein's Mass is controversial. Written in 1971 to inaugurate the Kennedy Center, he'd been great friends with JFK, it was dismissed at the time as, well, kitsch, over-theatrical, and indeed to some in the White House, positively dangerous. But as the years go by, it's increasingly considered to be Bernstein's masterpiece, the work in which you can most clearly discern his character, his political and personal views, and his conflicts. Its message is broadly, make love, not war, and its structure is based, loosely, on the Catholic Mass, which the Jewish Bernstein always found very moving. But it's intercut with any number of tropes and meditations, which are opportunities for Bernstein's main protagonist, the celebrant, and his flock, the street people, to cast doubt and challenges before resolution and faith is rediscovered through a shared belief in music. Well, talking of music, it is a smorgasbord, I think is the word, of different styles, some pre-recorded and played into the hall. We've got rock and blues juxtaposed with church organ and full orchestra, the highbrow with the vernacular, as someone put it. There is certainly something for lovers of Bernstein's West Side Story and also of his Chichester Psalms. For the performers themselves, well, it's a riot, and for members of the four school choirs in particular, it is going to be a very memorable evening.
Yeah, it's great. It's an amazing opportunity to be in the Proms.
We get to learn Latin, because all the songs are in Latin, and we get to perform in the Albert Hall. It's quite posh, to be honest.
Yeah, I thought, wow, it's going to be amazing. It's massive, because there's loads of people there. And
I'll just look happy, and I'll be fine.
Sing my best, that's all I can do. It's really good, it's fun, learning the words and playing the kazoo and
I was excited to be singing with all these people, and they sing very loudly when they do sing. It hurts my ears a bit, actually.
Well, it didn't hurt mine earlier. It was sounding fabulous. But how does this slightly crazy work from the 70s work in 2012? Is it still relevant? Does it still have a message? Well, here's conductor Christian Jervi again.
It's a serious piece, but it's one of these pieces which, without the light, you can't have the dark. You know? And particularly here, it means everything, because it is a piece that really questions basically every belief you have. The faith you have, or the faith you have in your social structure, and questioning authority in general. On the other hand, it doesn't dismiss it altogether. It says there are some good things, but you got to question everything. And in fact, that's what I'm trying to encourage everybody, including the musicians and the orchestra chorus, to remind them that this is a theater piece, really a theater piece which comes across from their acting, not only their singing and not only their playing.
Do you agree with the statement? I think it was Bernstein's daughter said that this piece really was the personification of her father. This was pure Lenny.
Absolutely. I think this is his greatest gift that he has left us.
Well, there are hundreds of musicians poised here at the Royal Albert Hall, most of them Welsh. We have the BBC National Orchestra and Chorus of Wales. We have the National Youth Orchestra and Youth Choir of Wales. Musicians from the Royal Welsh College of Music and Drama. Two particular soloists to mention. The Celebrant, sung by Danish baritone Morten Frank Larsen, making his Proms debut. And treble Julius Fu, who's a music scholar at Eton. And coming to the stage now to conduct this wonderful work is Christian Yeah. You can find programme notes and the text for this work on the BBC Proms website.
Sing the Lord a new song, to praise Him, to bless Him, to bless the Lord. I will sing His praises while I live all of my days. Blessed is a man who loves the Lord. Blessed is a man who praises Him. Lauda, lauda, laude, and walks in His ways. I will lift up my eyes to the hills from whence comes my help. I will lift up my voice to the Lord, singing louder, louder. For the Lord is my shade, is the shade upon my right hand. And the sun shall not smite me by day, nor the Blessed is the man who loves the Lord. Lauda, lauda, laude, and walks in his way.
Thank you.
Viscum. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Let us rise and pray. Almighty Father, bless this house, and bless and protect all who are assembled in it. I confess to Almighty God, to Blessed Mary, ever Virgin, to Blessed Michael the Archangel, to Blessed John the Baptist, to the Holy Apostles Peter and Paul.
I keep on kind of enjoying it. Why I drift off to sleep with pledges of deep resolve again. Then along comes the day and suddenly they dissolve again. I don't know what I say, I don't feel, what I feel, I don't know. What I saw isn't real, what is real, Lord. I don't know, no, 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 I don't know. To the holy man and I confessed. Look, I can beat my breast with the best, and I'll say almost anything that gets me blessed upon request. It's easy to shake the blame for any crime by trotting out that mea culpa pantomime. Yes, yes, I'm bad, I've sinned, I'm sad. Then go out and do it one more time.
I don't know where to start. There's so much I could show if I open my heart.
far, Lord, far, far can I go? I don't know.
If you ask me to love you on a bed of spies, well, that might be nice, once or twice. But don't look for sacraments or sacrifice. They're not worth the price. It's easy to keep the flag from your affair. Your body's always ready, but your soul's not there. Don't be nonplussed. Come, love, come, lost. It's so easy when you just don't care.
What I need, I don't have. What I have, I don't own. What I own, I don't want. What I want, Lord, I don't know. If you ask me to sing you verse that's versatile, I'll be glad to beguile you for a while. But don't look for content beneath the style. Sit back and smile. It's easy for you to dig my jim jam jive. And baby, please observe how neatly I survive. And what could give more positive plain proof that living is easy when you're half alive?
Life is low. Life is low.
Thank you. Gloria tibi, gloria tibi, gloria.
Gloria tibi, gloria tibi, gloria.
Gloria patri,
gloria filio,
et spiritui santo.
Spiritui santo.
Laudamus te, adoramus te, glorificamus te, benedicimus te. Gloria!
And peace on earth to men of good will.
Gloria in excelsis Deo et in terra pax omnibus bonae voluntatis.
Adoramus te, adoramus te, benedicimus te, glorificamus te.
Gratias agimus te in propter magnam gloriam tuam.
Domine Deus ex celestis Deus pater omnipotens.
Domine.
Yeah.
I'm swimming in the wrong direction.
Let us pray. Dear brothers, this is the gospel I preach, and in its service I have suffered hardship like a criminal, yea, even unto imprisonment. But there is no imprisoning the word of God.
Dearly beloved, do not be surprised if the world hates you. We who love our brothers have crossed over to life. But they who do not love abide in death. Everyone who hates his brother is a murderer.
Dear Mom and Dad, nothing will make me change my mind. Do not feel badly or worry about me. Try to understand. I am now a man.
You can lock up the bold man. Go and lock up your bold men and hold men in tow. You can stifle all adventure for a century or so. Smother hope before it's risen, watch it risen like a ghost. But you cannot imprison the word of the Lord.
No, you cannot imprison the word of the Lord.
For the word was at the birth of the beginning. It made the heavens and the earth and set them spinning. And for several million years, it's endured a lot of thorns and fine ideas. It's been rough, but it appears to be winning. There are people who doubt it. There are people who doubt it and shout it out loud. Oh, they bellow and they bluster till they muster up a crowd. They can fashion a rebuttal that's as subtle as a sword, but they're never gonna scuttle the word of the Lord.
No, they're never gonna scuttle the word of the Lord.
Dear brothers, I think that God has made us apostles the most abject of mankind. We hunger and thirst. We are naked, we are roughly handled, and have no fixed abode. They curse us and we bless. They persecute us and we suffer it. They treat us as the scum of the earth, the dregs of humanity, to this very day.
Dear folks, Jim looked very well on my first visit. With his head clean shaven, he looked about 19 years old. For the first few days, he is not allowed any books except his Bible. When I hugged him, he smelled so good, a smell of plain clean soap. He smelled like a child when you put him to bed.
All you big men of merit, all you big men of merit who ferret our flaws, you rely on our compliance with your science and your laws. Find a freedom to demolish while you polish some award, but you cannot abolish the word of the Lord.
No, you cannot abolish the word of the Lord.
For the word created matter and got it going. It filled our empty brains with blood and set it flowing. And for thousands of regimes, it's endured all our follies and fancy schemes. It's been tough, but it seems to be growing. Oh, you people of power! So we wait in silent treason until reason is restored. And we wait for the season of the word of the Lord. We await the season of the word of the Lord. We wait. We wait for the word of the Lord.
God said, let there be light, and there was light.
Let there be night, and there was night.
God said, let there be day, and there was day.
To follow the night.
And it was good, brother.
And it was good, brother.
And it was good, brother.
And it was goddamn good.
God said, Let there be storms, storms to bring life
in all of its forms, forms such as
herds and gaggles and swarms, swarms that have names
and numbers and norms.
And it was good, brother,
and it was good, brother,
and it was good, brother,
and it was goddamn good.
God said, let there be gnats, let there be sprats,
to gobble the gnats, so that the sprats
may nourish the rats, making them fat,
fine food for the cats.
And they grew fat, brother,
and they grew fat, brother,
and of the men, brother,
they all grew fat.
To be poor.
Good man must not be secure.
So if we steal from you, it's just to help you stay pure. And it was good.
God said, take charge of my food.
I
made these creatures for you.
So
they won't mind if we wipe out a species or two.
The man is out of our hands. And it was good.
God said that sex should repulse.
Unless it leads to results.
And so we crowd the world full of consenting adults. And it was good.
God said it's good to be meek.
God said it's good to be meek.
And so we are once a week. It may not mean a lot, but oh, it's terribly chic.
And it was good.
God made us the boss.
God gave us the cross.
We turned it into a sword.
God said, let there be day, and there was day. To follow the night.
And it was good, brother,
and it was good,
brother,
and it was good, brother,
and it was.
I believe in one God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, and of all things visible and invisible, and in one Lord.
Seculum Deum, 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 and Deum, 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 Deum,
Small social call. I tell you, sir, you never were a man at all. Why? You had the choice when to live, when to die, and then become a god again. And then a plaster god like you asked the god to tell me what to do to become a man. To show my respect on my knees. Go turn your flank, but don't expect guarantees or hope. Just play it dumb, play it blind, but when I go, then will I become a god again?
Possibly, yes, probably no.
Yes, probably no. Give me a choice. I never had a choice. I would have been a simple tree, a barnacle in a silent sea. Anything but one I must be. And then revive again. You chose, you rose alive again. But I don't know why I should live if only to die. Well, I'm not gonna buy it.
Possibly yes, probably no.
I'll never say credo. How can anybody say credo? I wanna say
credo.
God, but does God believe in me? I'll believe. God, if any God there be, that's a pat. Shake on that, don't take him back. I believe in one God, but then I believe in three. I'll believe in 20 gods if they believe in me. That's a pact, shake on that, no taking back. Who created my lot, made me come to be? Who accepts this awful responsibility? Is there someone out there? If there is, then who? Are you listening to this song? I'm singing just for you. I'll believe in everything nice. I believe in you and you and you and who believe in me.
Let us pray. Let us pray! Tim, Matt, Julius, Adrian, Christian, and all here present whose faith is known to thee, and for whom we offer up this sacrifice, we beseech thee in the fellowship of communion graciously to accept it and grant peace to our days.
Oh, Jesus, who so desired.
this day our daily bread. And forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from stay young, have left us parched and old instead. When my courage crumbles, when I feel confused and frail, when my spirit falters on decaying altars and my illusions fail, I go on. Right then, I go on again, I go
Yeah.
but me with soul, me with soul, me soul. Means a song is beginning to grow. Take wing and rise up singing from me and my soul. Immaculatam.
Dona nobis pacem.
Pacem,
pacem, pacem.
Domine. than that odd. Red wine isn't red at all. It's sort of brown, brown and blue. I never noticed that. What are you staring at? Haven't you ever seen an accident before? Look, isn't that odd? Glass shines brighter when it's broken. I never noticed that. Oh, easily things get broken. Blood. I mean, it is blood. His. It was. How easily things get broken. What are you staring at? Haven't you ever seen an accident before? Come on, come on, admit it. Confess it was fun, wasn't it? You know it was exciting to see what I'd done. Come on, you know you love it. You died for more. Wasn't it smashing to see it all come crashing right down to the floor? Right, we're right, little brothers. You were right all along. Little brothers and sisters, it was I who was wrong. So earnest, so solemn, as stiff as a column. Louder, louder, louder. Little brothers and sisters, you were right all along. It's gotta be exciting, it's gotta be strong. Come on, come on and join me. Come join in the fun. Shatter and splatter, pitcher and platter. What do we care? We won't be there. What does it matter? What does it matter? Our Father who art in heaven, haven't you ever seen an accident before? Listen. Isn't that odd? We can be so still, so still and numb. How easily things get quiet. Thank you.
of men. Don't let him die.
Just go on without me. Stop waiting. What is there about me that you've been respecting? And what have you all been expecting to see? Take a look. There is nothing but me under this. There is nothing you'll miss. Put it on and you'll see any one of you can be any one of me. What? Are you still waiting? Still waiting for me? Me alone to sing you into heaven? Well, you're on your own. Come on, say it. What has happened to all of your vocal powers? Sing it, pray it. Where's that mumbo and jumbo I've heard for hours? Praying and pouting, praying and shouting, listening. Chanting your pistols, bouncing your missiles on your knees. Go on whining, pining, moaning, intoning, groaning, obscenities. Why have you stopped praying? Stop your hearing. Where is your crying and complaining? Where is your lying and profaning? Where is your agony? Where is your malady? Where is your parody of God? Said, let there be, and there was God. Said, let there be. Beata Mariam sempre virginem. Beata miss the gloria. I don't sing. Gratias arimus tibi propter magnam gloriam tu. Amen, 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 amen. I'm in a hurry and come again. When you said you'd come. Come, love, come, lust. It's so easy if you just don't care. Lord, don't you care if it all ends today? Profundis. Clamari, a te domine, a dominum, a do. I don't know this. Miserere nobis. Me alone is only me, but me with soul, me with me. Oh, I suddenly feel every step I've ever taken. And my legs are laid. And I suddenly see every hand I've ever shaken. And my arms are
dead. I feel every song that I've ever sung turn to wormwood on my tongue. And I wonder, oh, I wonder, was I ever really young? It's of glass on the floor. How fine it would be to rest my head and lay me down, down in the wine which was really red. But sort of brown, and let not another word be spoken.
Mass is ended. Go in peace.
Leonard Bernstein's theatre piece, Max. An extraordinary work, conducted by Christian Järvi, who's bringing the hundreds of musicians on the stage to their feet as the Welsh flags are waved here at the Royal Albert Hall. Moments of high drama and emotion, but lots of humour too, in the last hour and a half or so. I should pay particular mention, I think, to the children's kazoos and to their dancing. It's worth watching it on BBC 4 on September the 6th for those moments alone, but a wonderful performances all around. Huge amount of musicians, as I say, on the stage tonight, six choirs. Let me tell you about some of them now. I should mention that the celebrant was sung by the Danish baritone Morten Frank Larsen. The solo boy was sung by Julius Fu. And the Masked Children's Choir, who did so well, comprised four Welsh school choirs. Ysgol Gynradd Gymraeg Coricorp, Piadydd. Ysgol Gynradd Gymanedol Gymraeg Llanfisant. Ysgol Gynradd Dolau Fanharan. And Ysgol Gynradd Gymraeg Cydydaman. And they are being cheered now by the adult choirs and the orchestra and their chorus master extraordinaire, Adrian Partington. They're all primary school children who've had the night of their life. Great smiles on their faces now. The street choir, the street people, are being cheered too, but that particular round of applause actually is for the National Welsh Chorus, who are singing alongside the National Youth Chorus of Wales. And the Eilwyd Awain of Fevel, a youth choir, winner of many a nice dead bod. And Christian Järvi bringing the BBC National Orchestra of Wales to their feet, and also the BBC National Youth Orchestra of Wales, who've been playing alongside them. What a wonderful experience that must be. He's now directing our attentions to the rock band. Now they comprise Matt Herskovitz on the piano, Damian Baseman on drums, and Matt Fields on double bass, and students from the Royal Welsh College of Music and Drama. Julius Fu getting a huge cheer. Currently a music scholar at Eton, previously head chorister at St John's College. And that choir for our celebrant baritone Morten Frank Larsen. But I must tell you about the street people, because my goodness, we heard some marvellous singing from there. It's a specially formed ensemble from students from the Royal Welsh College of Music, some past, some present, the Welsh College of Music and Drama. And we heard a lot of solos from tonight, and I just want to give them the credit they're due, because they really did give it their all, and they got a wonderful reaction here in the hall. The sopranos you heard were Jennifer Walker, Rhianna Llewellyn, Sian Wynne-Stanley, Vanessa Bowers, Rhianne Mayer-Lewis and Shoshana Pavitt. The altos were Catherine Walker, Helen Bruce, Dawn Burns and Kate Jarman. Tenors were Ronald Sam, Will Helliwell, Peter Harris, Sean Owen and Gareth Treseda. And the basses were Jan Kopinski, Stefan Jones, Edwin Hillier and Tim Nelson. It is a staged piece, and I just want to quickly pay tribute to the stage director, Thomas Kemal, who's just been brought onto the stage by Christian Järvi. What a tour de force from him as well. It's been an amazing night. Lots of people to thank, lots of people to pay tribute to, but I hope I've got everybody in, because now, after this extraordinary performance of Bernstein's Mass, it is time to say goodbye from the Royal Albert Hall and hand you back to Jonathan Swain in Broadcasting House.
Thank you very much, Katie. Katie Derham there at the Royal Albert Hall. And as she mentioned, there's a chance to see that prom on BBC 4 television in exactly a month from now, the 6th of September. As for tomorrow night's prom here on good old Steam Radio, Wagner's Tristan Prelude, James McMillan's Credo and Bruckner's Symphony No. 6 with Juan Jimena conducting the BBC Philharmonic. That's tomorrow night here on Radio 3 starting at 7:30. As for this Sunday...
On Radio 3 from the BBC Proms, a choral blockbuster to coincide with the closing night of the Olympics. Guralida, an early Schoenberg masterpiece, with a starry cast of soloists, the BBC Symphony Chorus and Orchestra, the BBC Singers and two guest choirs. A magnificent work it took the composer 11 years to write. Schoenberg's Guralida from the BBC Proms, Sunday night on BBC Radio 3 from 8 o'clock.
Well, back to this evening here on Radio 3, and in just under 20 minutes, a Proms Plus feature on Margaret Atwood's groundbreaking feminist novel, The Handmaid's Tale, 25 years after its publication, a novel in which a religious revolution has overthrown the American government. And after Proms Plus, the Lebrecht interview. Norman Lebrecht's guest tonight is the impresario Lillian Hochhauser, who, along with her husband Victor, introduced British audiences to some of the greatest Russian musicians of all time, Rostropovich and Richter among them. The Lebrecht interview is this evening at 9:30. For the moment, British music, one English piece which can't really be compared with much else because of its almost unique scoring, is Michael Tippett's Sonata for Four Horns. I say almost because there is, in fact, another one by Hindemith. There's also, of course, Schumann's dazzling Konzertstück for Four Horns and Orchestra. Tippett wrote his sonata in the 1950s for horn player of legend Dennis Brain and his Philharmonia colleagues. And the cascading hunting calls of the opening movement seem to recall the Tennyson setting Blow, Bugle, Blow in Benjamin Britten's Serenade for Tenor, Horn and Strings. Then compare that with the barbershop harmonies of the nocturnal third movement. Tippett's sonata is played here by the Barry Tuckwell Horn Quartet. And before it, you'll hear more Tippett for brass, an early fanfare of his, played by the Philip Jones Brass Ensemble.
Thank you.
Michael Tippett's Sonata for Four Horns, played there by the Barry Tuckwell Horn Quartet, and before it, Tippett's Fanfare for Brass, played by the Philip Jones Brass Ensemble. This is BBC Radio 3. It's coming up to 12 minutes past 10. And it's time now to join Anne McElvoy for tonight's Proms Plus literary event, recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music.
Margaret Atwood's award-winning 1985 novel, The Handmaid's Tale, was a milestone in feminist writing and a warning to her fellow feminists who may have had grounds for thinking that their key battles had been won or at least were listing in their direction. Equal access to education, the vote, contraception and abortion had been the demands of the 1960s sisterhood, but our subject today counselled scepticism about such progress. As the religious right gained political traction in the US with Jerry Falwell's moral majority boosting the standing of a successful Republican leader in Ronald Reagan, Atwood suggested there might be rather more for feminists and liberals in general to worry about. The result was a powerful imagining of a dystopia which melded the worst traits of historical dictatorships in its callous regard for the individual with a gruesome projection of a tainted theocracy gone mad. The Handmaid's Tale won her an Arthur C. Clarke Award and many followers beyond her core as a feminist writer. It's a novel that feels a bit like science fiction, but Atwood prefers the term speculative fiction. She also maintains that every form of oppression in the novel has existed in some time and in some place. My guests tonight are the writer Aminata Fauna and the broadcaster Kate Adey. Aminata, if I could start with you, there's nothing as shocking as the reality that is reflected in this book.
It's a book in which you recognise a great deal of what is going on in the world as it is now and in the world as it has been in the past. In Gilead, this theocratic dictatorship, systems of power are put in place which mimic patriarchy. I suppose they're based on patriarchy, but actually they are systems that we all know quite well that have been subsumed in that particular regard and to promote a small group of people into a privileged position. So actually when you unpick what Gilead actually is, you do find these reflections of the world that we know or have sometimes stepped into.
And just before we come to the reading, she has to set up how we get from a point where her country, in this case it's nominally the United States, has been taken over by this system. Just roughly how is that set up?
Well, it actually starts with something very tiny, and I think that's the reading we're going to hear about here. But the way it's set up, and this is where Atwood was extraordinarily prescient, is that she actually says that the powers that be used the idea of Islamic fundamentalist threat in order to justify what start off with very tiny repressions. And they also use the Bible, they use certain selective texts from principally the Old Testament to justify their actions and actually corral people in something that is meant to be, first of all, for their own good, but of course which turns out very differently.
So, Melanie Gregg, please give us the first reading from The Handmaid's Tale.
It was after the catastrophe, when they shot the president and machine-gunned the Congress and the army declared a state of emergency. They blamed it on Islamic fanatics at the time. Keep calm, they said on television. Everything is under control. I was stunned. Everyone was, I know that. It was hard to believe. The entire government gone like that. How did they get in? How did it happen? That was when they'd suspended the Constitution. They said it would be temporary. There wasn't even any rioting in the streets. People stayed home at night watching television, looking for some direction. There wasn't even an enemy you could put your finger on. Look out, said Moira to me over the phone. Here it comes. Hear what comes, I said. You wait, she said. They've been building up to this. It's you and me up against the wall, baby. Tried getting anything on your CompuCard today? They've frozen them, she said. Any account with an F on it instead of an M. All they need to do is push a few buttons, we're cut off. But I've got over $2,000 in the bank, I said, as if my own account was the only one that mattered. Women can't hold property anymore, she said. It's a new law. Turned on the TV today. No, I said. It's on there, she said. Luke can use your CompuCount for you, she said. They'll transfer your number to him, or that's what they say, husband or male next of kin.
It's very much...
Yes, I wanted to ask you, Kate, I mean, you've seen a lot of beginnings of dictatorships and things going on. Not exactly like the example we heard there, but does it remind you of things in real life?
Absolutely. And Margaret Atwood has about only that single description in the whole book of what has happened. There are other little hints here and there. That is an entire revolution, a huge... upturning of lives, particularly women's lives, because what is in the end of that description is that they've lost their bank accounts. They can't sign things anymore. By the time this revolution has pushed through, women have been deprived of any kind of status other than that of being mothers. The threat within the novel is said to be... a lack of children because of pollution, because of all kinds of contraception, because of things going wrong in modern society. So women need to give birth. And by the time we're into the novel, you realize that this is a world which entirely centers around women having to act as vessels, nothing more. They are not going to be mothers of their own children. They're having children from other people. And I think more than anything, I reread it and realized that this is a quarter of a century ago. And it was written, I think, in the sense, as you mentioned, of how far women have come, what they've got rid of in the restrictions. And we go into this world and find there are even more restrictions, and they've slid in. They've absolutely, completely destroyed women's independence, and women have no power. Because at the end, I think, it's a novel about power.
Let's come back to that, and also perhaps to what happens later in the novel. But Aminata, there are moments of prescience which you've already alluded to, like the mention of Islamic fundamentalists being blamed for an attack on Congress or for other political ends. A very lively argument today about how much democracies should adjust and change themselves for the terror threat. But this is written in what she couldn't know, but it's the dying phase of the Cold War. I mean, does she sort of miss the point?
I don't know, because I think she was so ahead of her time. She actually wrote this in Berlin and said that it was partly prompted by the Berlin Wall and what was going on both sides of the wall, specifically, of course, you know, in East Berlin. So she also, when the book, as the book moves on, it's an alternative future, isn't it? It's not the future, it's an alternative future. If we take one path, that's where we might go. That's how Margaret Atwood plays with this idea. It's set in the late 20th century. So I think she... you know, to me, it wasn't really about the Cold War. It was really about safeguarding democracy and how democracy has to be safeguarded, how one has to be eternally vigilant about the things that seem so tiny, things like bank accounts. I mean, actually, that's quite big to me, but, you know, in the scale of what happens in this book, you know, the bank accounts are quite small. And it's also extraordinary how Luke, the protagonist's husband, at first, he doesn't have a problem with it, you see, because her bank account is taken away and put in his name, and he becomes her protector, and he is elevated, and that's what's so seductive about the use of power.
Which is often a claim made by new governments removing rights from a section of society, isn't it? That it is there for the protection of women or the protection of children or the protection of a particular tribe or group. Kate, you've seen rather a lot of this.
She has, you know, in her narrator, a woman who is quite ambivalent about how she relates to the man whom she loves. And then this complete change comes over society. And she, instead of being able to fight it, she is horrified within herself to find she can't find a means of fighting this. It is so all-embracing. And I am reminded time and again, I think, of women whom you do meet in some cultures who we in the West say, why don't you protest? Why don't you get together? Why don't you organize? Why don't you, and you know, you have your little list of things which we had in the 70s when we were talking about liberation. And this is going to be the action. And they say, you can't. The law says you can't. They have the power. We can't go out. We have no way of meeting. We may not do. And I've heard this myself from women today in certain societies and cultures. And Margaret Atwood brings this out with such clarity. And it's got, to me, huge flashing neon warning signs all over it.
Well, that's very interesting. See, I read it back in the day, probably not long after it came out, and I really warmed to it and I enjoyed the book, but rereading it now, and it'd be very interesting to hear any thoughts on this, I did think this is a slightly hysterical book, frankly, and also that she does miss the point. She can't just say, well, I'm sitting in Berlin and it's also about East Germany. Really, it is about a distrust of America. Really, it is about a trust of Christian fundamentalism. And what she seems sort of oblivious to is the fact that a lot of the countries have got many more of the things that she's describing in the book going on, or those which have rebelled against religion.
Oh, you see, I don't see it that way. I mean, Gilead is in America, but it could be anywhere. To me, what she's talking about is the slippery slope towards dictatorship. You know, you could use the same trajectory and put it on anywhere. So I think that was actually...
But she does suggest that you've got to believe that she thinks you're somewhere on it, otherwise it's not really a dystopia. If you think, well, this might happen, but it's very, very, very unlikely to ever happen, then you wouldn't take the book seriously. You have to have that distrust of America that she really has, and it seeps through every pore of the book.
I can think of two instances. First of all, when I was a student, I spent a lot of time listening to other students who managed to sneak out of the Soviet Union and came to Sweden where I was studying because they thought it was sort of neutral and okay and vaguely lefty. So they'd allow their students out, and I met Poles and Hungarians and Czechs and Russians. And they all said to me, as we all sat drinking late at night and saying, what's life really like where you live? And they'd say, you don't understand how to hang on to democracy. You don't seem to bother. You don't seem to care about it. You take it for granted. And I've never forgotten that. They said, we thought some of the smaller countries had a period of independence. They said, it is taken away from you if you don't fight for it. And the second instance was listening to women in Iran, in the Grand Mosque, where just after the Ayatollahs had taken over, and these educated, clever women who'd had jobs, been independent, said, you don't know how they can take it from you. And it's not just unfair, it's unjust, it's evil, they said. And look, the world is just watching us. And here we are in our cage. And I've never forgotten. That is what comes through to me.
And there's a wonderful moment when Japanese tourists arrive in Gilead and look at the women. Yes. And have exactly the same reaction to them as we might have if we were going to a country where women's rights were not as advanced as here.
I think that's a very good point to hear a little bit more from the book, which tells us about how the women in Gilead interact with each other. Melanie.
A shape, red with white wings around the face, a shape like mine, a nondescript woman in red carrying a basket, comes along the brick sidewalk towards me. She reaches me and we peer at each other's faces, looking down the white tunnels of cloth that enclose us. She is the right one. Blessed be the fruit, she says to me, the accepted greeting among us. May the Lord open, I answer, the accepted response. We turn and walk together past the large houses towards the central part of town. We aren't allowed to go there except in twos. This is supposed to be for our protection, though the notion is absurd. We are well protected already. The truth is that she is my spy, as I am hers. If either of us slips through the net because of something that happens on one of our daily walks, the other will be accountable. The war is going well, I hear, she says. Praise be, I reply. We've been sent good weather, which I receive with joy. They've defeated more of the rebels since yesterday. Praise be, I say. I don't know how she knows. What were they? Baptists. They had a stronghold in the Blue Hills. They smoked them out. Praise be. Sometimes I wish she would just shut up and let me walk in peace. But I'm ravenous for news, any kind of news. Even if it's false news, it must mean something.
She is very good, isn't she, Aminata, at the interpersonal relationships which are built up in the book between the women and also between the woman and the man who is supposed to be trying to impregnate her in this sort of strange society which wants to be so moral and then ends up in sort of moral turpitude.
Everybody's fighting for their own little bit of turf, and it's quite interesting how people allow themselves to be divided in that way. What I found interesting about the book, we've talked about it in terms of feminism and women's rights, but actually everybody in Gilead is oppressed, you know, all but the most powerful men. The poorer men cannot get married, they have to work for the wealthier men. They are almost as oppressed as the women whom they are in turn oppressing. And everyone is fighting for their tiny piece of turf. And there's another wonderful moment where Serena Joy, who is the wife of the commander, she's the alpha woman, and there's a wonderful moment where he comes to her sitting room door, isn't there, and he's always supposed to knock before he comes in, and that's her tiny piece of turf. It's all she's got left, actually, is the power to say yes when he knocks on the door. But they're all constantly...
What did you make of the sort of polygamy side of it, which does give the book a frisson? I mean, I think if one's being honest, people quite like reading the books about the sex. But it is sort of odd in the sense that it is both reflecting on religious polygamy and Mormons and people who've had a history of it. But did it ring true to you? Because I know you've studied some countries with polygamous societies.
Yes, I mean, it was actually the least convincing part of the book, really, was the relationship between the first wife and the handmaid. And, you know, I mean, my family in Sierra Leone, my grandfather had 16 wives, so I had a little bit of experience of polygamy. And I spent a long time, I wrote a novel set in a polygamous household, and spent a lot of time talking to my aunts and my grandmothers about the way that the household had run. And the first wife, and all of the power in the household, really belonged to the first wife, whose power in the domestic sphere was far greater even than of her husband. She usually
Did you feel it here, the handmaid
ends up with too much power and it really wouldn't happen.
Well, Nick's favourite wife, of course, is the next person who has a great deal of power. But I did feel that Serena Joy's kind of hopelessness wasn't quite convincing. I thought she would be more of a fighter.
No, I've known people in the Arab world where the first wife cannot have the child and then just gets elbowed out, but still is kept on as the wife, and the second one is married for childbearing possibilities. And the first wife has this kind of this position, but has lost that great lever, which is the important thing to the man, the ability to continue the line.
Do you know what it really reminded me of? And that was Bring Up the Bodies by Hilary Mantel, where as we study Anne Boleyn's descent, really from the point where she, the beginning of the novel, she's incredibly powerful because she's still thought to be able to bear an heir and bring an heir up. And when it sort of, as it becomes clearer and clearer that there are problems on that score.
But it still happens today in those societies. And the whole thing is backed by, and I think you mustn't, I think it does matter, and matters particularly today, by the book is suffused with biblical phrases and the idea that there is the ultimate arbiter and it is what is written in the Old Testament. And there is no questioning of that. And in societies where that takes hold, it reaches a point where there is no protest because there is nothing to appeal to, because what has been written down is perfect and that is how you live. And I find it, and I've seen it occasionally, it is very frightening. And I think she delivers the fear and the whole of society. As you're quite right, not only does not everyone have any real power, but they're also afraid, all of them, for their own position.
It's all very downbeat, but without giving too much away for anyone who hasn't read it, there is then a prologue. No, the other way around. There is then an epilogue, which suggests that all of these things do come to an end. I mean, she's not quite as doom-mongery about women in society in the end, because she assumes that change is possible. And there's a little trick at the end which makes that clear.
You're not saying light, that it lightens it. It's a sense of relief that she wrote it to say, oh, well, actually, this was a phase that passed. Well, don't we all feel relieved that she herself has written it that way?
She says she has two endings, and and the second ending is contained in that epilogue. But I think that's actually what's so clever about it, is that if we think that progress, is the relentless march forward, actually, there is also regress.
Well, then we must leave it. Me, Anne McElvoy, my thanks to Aminata Fauna, Kate Adie, and Melanie Gray, and good night.
Anne McElvoy presented this evening's Proms Plus Literary event, and the producer was Laura Thomas. BBC Radio 3, it's time now for Norman Lebrecht with the Lebrecht Interview.
Lillian Hochhauser is a household name in millions of musical homes. The Hochhauser Sunday concerts that she ran with her husband Victor at the Royal Albert Hall introduced countless people to the live sound of a symphony orchestra. The menu was popular fare from the 1812 overture via the Grieg Concerto to Planets, Enigma, Beethoven's Ninth, but it gave many listeners the concert bug and many musicians a foothold on the career ladder. Lillian and Victor were also purveyors of high art. They brought the Vienna Philharmonic to London after the war and were the sole importers of Soviet talent after Stalin died. They enjoyed close friendships with Oistrakh, Rostropovich and other legends, and staged the first Shostakovich festivals outside the Soviet bloc. Their Russian ballet seasons continue to this day. In the opposite direction, they gave many British musicians and dancers their debut on Russian stages. Now that's the public face of the Hochhausers. The private story is even more remarkable. Raised in the ultra-Orthodox Jewish quarter of Stamford Hill, they were propelled into the music business by a rabbi who refused to take no for an answer. Their sense of mission was so strong that in their 80s there's no sign of slowing down. For the past 11 years, this summer excepted, they've kept the Royal Opera House alive in July and August. I meet Lillian Hochhauser in a BBC studio. Lillian, there were only two festivals that were suspended for the Olympic summer, Glastonbury and you.
Exactly.
Was that a logistical decision?
Well, it was forced on me. I mean, I wanted to be at the Royal Opera House, but they were not available because they were very much concerned with the Olympics and the Cultural Olympiad,
yeah.
And they have an exhibition. Anyway, there was no time and no room. So I had to take a sabbatical.
Do you remember the last Olympics? You must do.
Of course, I remember 1948.
Yes.
Strangely enough, I was in Switzerland at the time. I had a health problem, and I was lying on a Liegestuhl on a outside on a balcony in Davos.
On a magic mountain.
On a magic mountain, reading the Magic Mountain, of course, naturally. Mm-hmm. And just below my hotel, they staged the Winter Olympics. So I remember that very clearly indeed.
Tell me about working for Solomon Schonfeld, Rabbi Dr. Solomon Schonfeld.
After 1948, when I came back from Switzerland, I looked for a part-time position. And I had, of course, heard about him. Well, first of all, that he's very underrated because he was a great hero of the century.
Nobody saved more Jewish children from Europe before and after
thousands
the war.
Tens of thousands, that he brought out at
risk of his life.
Absolutely.
Flashing blue eyes.
Handsome, I have to say. Yes, indeed.
Ferociously articulate.
And intelligent. And would not let anything get in his way to fulfil his mission of bringing all the children he could from the 1938... till 1948. He even designed his own uniform. Nobody knew what it was, but it opened doors for him because he looked so impressive. He was so imposing.
He bought it at an Armley surplus store and he put on a badge that said Chief Rabbi's Emergency Squad.
Exactly. So I found it a very satisfying thing to work for such a person.
And then there was this young man who was hanging around in the office.
Yes, occasionally a young man came in he was already beginning to be known, in fact. Because
Victor.
This was in 1948. In 1945 came the start, the spur for his career. And that was as follows. Of course, Dr. Schoenfeld always needed money, a lot of money. He needed it. I mean, he had to get it.
Well, he
to
had
do
a house
his work.
And feed
exactly.
and clothe and educate
Absolutely.
The children.
And so he had the brilliant idea of putting on a charity concert. It so happened that in the synagogue that he often prayed, there was a gentleman by the name of Kuttner, whose son was Solomon Kuttner. Now, best known as Solomon. He's the only musician or pianist who uses his first name as his name. The others use their second name, but he was the only one, and he's still famous as Solomon. And in 1945, they booked, of all places, the Whitehall Theatre, which was actually known in those days for various not so salubrious.
It was
concerts.
A stripper's place.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Right. So these ultra-Orthodox Jews are booking a stripper's joint for a charity
place.
Concert.
Yes, but perhaps they didn't know. Perhaps I should say. Whatever it is, it was available. The concert was sold out. And a huge success. And they actually made a lot of money. It was so successful that they immediately, in 1945, Victor soon saw that this was a very good idea. And he booked the Albert Hall for two concerts. And not only that, in fact, Solomon did not appear at either of those concerts. The first artist to appear was Ida Handel. She was, I think, 17. They also proved successful. And so that continued with artists such as Moiseevich, Kentner, Sigeti, bigger and bigger artists were coming along.
Myra Hess.
One more, Limpany. Adrian Bolt conducted many of the concerts. Basil Cameron and, of course, Malcolm Sargent.
Mm-hmm. And Yehudi Menuhin.
Then Yehudi came along in 1949. Mm-hmm. Another very momentous thing happened in 1949, and that was I met Victor. He used to come into Schoenfeld's office.
Yes.
perch on the end of it. He didn't actually have his own office in those days. He used to perch at the end of my desk, and we got very friendly. I, of course, was already very interested in music, and I thought, well, this is very interesting. I knew Victor's name, and I thought, this sounds like a good idea. So I went full steam ahead, and I was 22, and I decided, well, it's time to get married, and we did.
You tell him it's time to get married.
Oh. Well, let's say that we both thought of the idea.
What were the qualities that you brought that Victor lacked?
Well, I wasn't bad looking in those days, for a start, you know.
So that helped with some negotiations. Yes.
My enthusiasm for music was undoubtedly a help, I would say. I quickly learned what it was all about. Victor had great courage and went forward, and in 1949, in fact, he had invited, as you said before, the Vienna Philharmonic with Furtwängler. It was a very great occasion, and of course, on looking back, it was a very big undertaking for two very young people to bring the Vienna Philharmonic to London. They came for 3 years after that, three consecutive years, during which time Yehudi played with them. They were conducted by Bruno Walter, Kathleen Ferrier sang, Joseph Cripps, Clemens Krauss. It was, in fact, a very overwhelming and wonderful experience to have.
Let me ask you, though, weren't there issues of conscience here? Victor had lost most of his family in the Holocaust. Vienna Philharmonic was full of players who until quite recently had been enthusiastic Nazis, and two of the conductors, Furtwängler and Clemens Krauss, had shaken Hitler's hand. Was this not a problem for you?
Well, personally, I was, and both of us, perhaps we were slightly naive in this and carried away with the idea of music and great music. Furtwängler, we know. I know that Furtwängler was not a Nazi by any means, by any means. At the time, I actually didn't know. I should have known. I do know now that Clemens Krauss was not so clean. But, of course, there was Joseph Cripps and there was Bruno Walter. And I thought, if Bruno Walter comes with them, then it's kosher. We were, in fact, so intent on bringing the best of music. And when this was suggested to us by someone, in fact, Aimpen Williams then, we ourselves found it irresistible.
How did you get involved with the Russians? I mean, did you hear on the radio, on the wireless, that Stalin had died and think, hello, we might be able to get in here?
Not on the day that Stalin died, which of course was the day that Prokofiev died, as we now know.
Mm.
But we knew the name of Oistrakh. We knew these people existed. I didn't know Rostropovich, of course, and Richter wasn't known in the West, but Oistrakh was. And I'd heard a recording. And, well, as one is with Oistrakh, one finds him the best, I mean, amongst the greatest. And there was a cultural delegation here. They started quite soon after Stalin died, or just even about the same time. They sent a cultural delegation was here with, it was Bela Davidovich, Gilels, and Oistrakh. But it was Igor.
The son.
It was Igor. And we thought, well, any Oistrakh, let's have Oistrakh. And we were organising our Sunday evening concerts. And we immediately changed the programme in order to accommodate Igor. He played Khachaturian concerto, and it was a huge success, of course, because the novelty of a Russian artist. The book had been closed for so many years. And, of course, we immediately sprung into action and said, well, if Igor is here, we must immediately invite David. And he did. He came, we did. And the following year, he came.
How did you go about that? Did you have to go through the Soviet embassy or was it...
Well, what we did, yes. I mean, we had to discover how to do this. We had a bit of help even from this delegation. They said you have to deal with the Ministry of Culture, and not only the Ministry of Culture, but the financial commercial arm of that, which is Goskonsert, with whom we dealt for the next 25 years.
Yeah. Did you speak Russian at the time?
Viktor was born in Slovakia, so he could understand Russian. I couldn't speak Russian,
right.
But I learnt afterwards, I, to a certain extent, that is. We found, actually, with the artists themselves, they all spoke German. My German was quite good. So we were able to converse in German. And Oistrakh came in 54. Then they were very interested, of course, to send their artists abroad. Life was slightly easier, naturally, after Stalin died. And they used to, of course, send them very closely guarded. We used to call them Sputniks. We sent them with their guards, and they were very closely watched. And it was a very strange situation because at the very beginning, they used to reverse the usual pattern of agent artists. They used to take 90% and give the artist 10%. So we had to augment that ourselves, which we did, of course. Mm. But to be able to invite someone like David Oistrakh was a dream, an absolute dream. He became our closest friend.
Did that open doors for
you? Yes, yes.
People knew that you were close to David Oistrakh and that
yes.
And other artists began to trust you.
The artists had more or less to do what they were told, more or less. Mm. In other words, it was Goskonsert you had to deal with, or Ministry of Culture. There were so many wonderful artists there. It was incredible, incredible. Richter, of course, was not allowed. We knew about Richter. We asked for Richter very early on, it wasn't until 1961 that they allowed him to come.
Mm-hmm.
He was forbidden to travel. We started to invite more and more. And not only that, but we began to look further and invite dance companies, ensembles. We started to nose around the Bolshoi and the Kirov, and in 1960 we brought a group of dancers from the, they were the very first time they came, in fact, to the Albert Hall. The first group of dancers came to the Albert Hall, and there were I remember that was very, it was, every time they came, everybody came, it was more and more exciting.
When did Slava Rostropovich come into the picture?
Rostropovich came to England in 1956 for the first time.
Right, you brought him.
We brought him in 56, and the hall was pretty empty, I have to say. We put him on, but that was the only time it was ever empty. He immediately was recognised as the genius that he was. I mean, really, great, great artist. And he was then 26, I suppose. Yes, he was about 26. And he came 56 and began to come quite regularly afterwards. We started to invite, we brought all the orchestras, every major Russian orchestra we brought during the late 50s, 60s.
Was there any resistance to that, any hostility from the musicians, the unions, even the government that you were?
No, we actually signed in conjunction on the first cultural agreement between the two countries together, because we were the only people dealing with Russian artists, we were the only people who had any knowledge of them at all. And then...
So what, it's an agreement between the United Kingdom, the Soviet Union and the Hochhausers?
That's right. Of course, we were subject to various diplomatic crises, such as when the Russians expelled 105 spies.
Spies, yes.
Yes, 105.
So there was still some left, I think.
At that time, we were supposed to have had... Oistrakh was supposed to come here. They cancelled. The Russians, in retaliation, they cancelled. They said, David Oistrakh is very, very upset about the action of the British government, and he will not appear in London. We managed to find David wherever he was at the time. Of course, he knew nothing about it. He didn't know anything about anything. Before this happened, there was a famous... 1968, when the Russians marched into Prague, and we were due, I think, to bring the Red Army Choir
to the Albert Hall.
Yes, and they were all plastered outside, big poster and somebody had torn it off and said, now appearing in Prague. In fact, then the British refused to issue
visas.
Them any visas. Mm. Rostropovich was playing in the Proms. The Moscow Philharmonic were here. And that all continued. That went ahead. And as you know, that was a very emotional moment when, of all things, Rostropovich was to perform and did perform the Dvořák Cello Concerto. And no one knew whether there was going to be any demonstration, trouble, and so on. Two people did get up and walked out in the middle shouting, Viva Casals! I haven't quite worked that one out, but anyway, that's the only thing that happened. So sometimes we were obviously affected by the political situation.
Tell me about Sviatoslav Richter, because Victor had the close relationships with David Oistrakh and with Rostropovich. They were.
Yes.
But Richter was really yours.
He was my boy.
Yes. And he is such an enigma and such an individual and so, in many respects, so uncontrollable. What was the nature of your relationship with him?
Well, we simply were able to talk together for hours.
About?
Generally, films. He loved going to the cinema. He was a wonderful painter and generally a most extraordinary person. He wouldn't speak on the telephone. If I wanted to ask him what he wanted to play, I'd have to travel to Vienna or something to find out, you know. And he, of course, loved to play in small places. I remember once having to sail over to Isola Bella, this little in Lake Maggiore, to go and find him there because he was living there while he was playing somewhere else.
But he cancelled a lot.
Oh, I suffered. He suffered terribly.
He had a tendency to disappear. You'd have to go scouring the streets for him at night.
Oh, my goodness, yes, he did. He cancelled as many times as he played. Once he cancelled 3 hours before the concert was due at the Festival Hall. Nina, his wife, she phoned up and 3 hours before the concert, a telephone call, and this quavering voice the other end, Lillian, and I knew that tone, you know, that's a cancellation tone. And so it was. She said, this Slav ist krank. He can't play. He's very ill. He's lying in a dark room and he can't. What could I do except to produce a huge poster, run to the festival hall, stand in the middle of all the people there and say, Richter is ill. By that time I had managed, it was a holiday actually, a bank holiday or something, and I had to find the manager on holiday, find out where and when we could do the concert again within the next few days. We found a slot 11 o'clock at night one evening, and I on this poster I put, you can have your money back, the tickets will be refunded, unless you want to come at 11 on such and such a date. And naturally, everybody came. And of course, another difficulty with working with Richter is he said, how can I possibly know what I feel like playing next year? I can't know that. I can't give you a programme now. I shall know a week beforehand, you know. And mostly, I had to advertise a concert without a programme in it.
Now, as you say, all of these Soviet artists came with their minders, their Sputniks, their spies, their people who were designed to...
At the beginning, it got a bit easier later, I have to say.
But you started putting them up in your house.
The only time we did that was when Rostropovich decided to leave in 1974.
When he was effectively pushed out.
Pushed out, exactly. Yeah. I mean, he had a correspondence with Brezhnev, as you probably remember. Yeah. He came to London and we went, four of us. There was Duncan Wilson, who was the ambassador in Moscow, and his wife Betty, and Victor and myself. We went to meet him at the airport. He was in a small private plane with his large dog, and he was totally and utterly lost. He walked down the stairs of the plane, and the dog came after him, and there was a huge cry, back with the dog, you know, because he just brought the dog.
To England.
And, of course, that was very tough. Mm.
Tell me about Dmitri Shostakovich. You brought him over.
Many times.
You put on this extraordinary Shostakovich Festival in Edinburgh. You managed to put on the Eighth Symphony pretty much over Soviet objections.
Yes. Now, that was very interesting, actually, because Mravinsky, who gave that performance, and he actually approached us to say, would we speak to Katerina Furtseva, who was the
Minister
of Culture. Whatever the case may be, it happened.
Well, she had banned it.
Well, she didn't, of course. Yeah, it was the Politburo or whatever. The Fourth was banned, as you know. Fourth Symphony was banned. The Eighth, naturally the 13th.
Well, the Fourth had been banned since 1935.
That's right. And then these were all symphonies that hadn't been performed in Russia, or at least once. But we arranged all those performances in London.
What were your dealings like with Dmitri Shostakovich himself?
We felt very close to him. It was not easy to talk to him. He was a very, very nervous, a driven man, a nervous man, a charming man.
Smoked a lot.
Couldn't eat in public. He was just absolutely withdrawn.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you felt his great nature. He was a lovely man. And he had this lovely young wife, Irina, who she's still, of course, we see her, we're in touch with her. You couldn't sit down and have small talk with him. That wasn't really what you did with Shostakovich. In 1972, we organised a very big festival of Soviet and Russian music, where he came and various other people came, Svidridov and various other composers, and Krennikov came, of course.
And the head of the composers union. Yes, yes. The last Stalinist.
The last Stalinist, indeed. Funnily enough, he was quite a nice man. I don't know.
When you talk about bureaucratic monsters like Furtseva and Krennikov, people who were responsible for oppressing artists and musicians, in some cases sending them to the camps, in many cases preventing them from leaving the Soviet Union, punishing them, sentencing them to internal exile. You make it sound like a bit of a game, that you were having a dance with them.
Well, yes. Now, it's a little unfair to bracket Krennikov and Furtseva, because, in fact, relatively speaking, Furtseva was quite a good woman, actually. She wasn't bad. She was the one person in power who, for many years, in fact, who had a great feeling for the artists. She would help them whenever she could. She would help them. And they came to her with all sorts of things. I mean, if they wanted an apartment, they used to apply to Furtseva to help them get somewhere to live, you know. And although she could be very fierce, as she was with us sometimes, when, for instance, we brought the Kirov Ballet to the festival hall, and there were enormous demonstrations everywhere against them. And she was very upset with us, and she said, she blamed us, and she said, you should have organised almost your own police force to. Well, we don't do things like that, you see. If people want to demonstrate, they demonstrate.
You brought over the ballet, I think, for the first time, just as Nureyev was in the act of defecting in Paris. Wasn't that right?
That was the first time we ever brought the Kirov Ballet to London. It was in 1961.
Hmm.
That is very much imprinted on my memory, because, can you imagine, it was the first time we had presented anything at Covent Garden, at the Royal Opera House. Very young, very excited, and it was a wonderful, wonderful thing to do. And we went to the airport with flowers, and when we got there, there were these long faces. Well, it was very strange. We didn't know. And, of course, then we found out why, that Nureyev had just an hour before jumped the barrier in Paris and defected. In fact, the programme, we had already heard about Nureyev, and we knew that he was 24 and really a wonderful dancer. So we featured him in the programme at the time. So nothing to be done. He wasn't there. And they were very frightened because they knew that someone would have to pay the price. There was the man in charge was a man called Corkin, who looked a bit more like a butcher than the director of the company. But anyway, he was very frightened of what would happen to him when he went back, because they would all be blamed for that. In fact, the three top people, there was Sergeyev, who was the artistic director, Dudinskaya, his wife, who had been, they'd both been dancers, she was a prima ballerina, and the director, Corkin. They all lost their jobs over that, they all lost their positions.
And then you were running this traffic the other way. You were taking BBC orchestras to Russia.
Oh, well, that happened in 1966. That was a fantastic event. In 1966, in December 1966, at the request of William Glock, at the time, he'd asked us to arrange the trip to Russia of the BBC Symphony Orchestra with Barbie Rolley and Pierre Boulez and Jacqueline Dupre. We went to Poland, we went to Prague, and we went to Moscow and Leningrad. And we had our concerts in Prague and in Poland, an enormous success. And we were on a night train from Warsaw to Moscow. I got a phone call from Victor, who'd gone on in advance, to say, I think we have to be warned, and sworn William, that they don't want to have the concerts with Boulez, because they had suddenly realised that they were letting in somebody who was avant-garde. They really had originally thought he was Barbie Rolley's assistant. So and so it turned out that we arrived there and they had prepared this huge table of caviar and vodka and most wonderful food you can imagine, and gently tried to persuade us to ask Mr. Boulez to go home. So William Glock got up and he said, "Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're all going together. We're all leaving." So there was confusion and chaos and so on. And so we had to find a way through it. So I think what we did in order to reach an agreement, we had later office numbers of Webern, and they thought maybe that would be more acceptable, you know, not the early ones. So we somehow got through it.
So Boulez was conducting Webern in Moscow in 1966.
Yes, and his own music. Yes, his own music.
I've heard from Russian musicians of three generations that this opened their ears to the world.
I have never heard applause. In the Philharmonic Hall in Leningrad, for instance, they were hanging over the edge. There were so many people in the hall. They couldn't get anymore in, and everybody was over the balconies. And he was conducting Eckler, I remember, Eckler. And immediately he had to perform it again. Because they would not let him go. There was such enthusiasm, such a thirst for new music. And secretly, in fact, he met quite a lot of the young modern composers.
You must have been spied upon pretty heavily when you were there.
Oh, well, you presumed you were. Yes. You simply did not even talk to the chandelier, because you knew, they could hear you. I don't suppose they listened to every single word. It would have been very boring indeed. You simply had to go for a walk. You could not speak in your room at all.
You were taking big risks of another kind. I don't know if you can talk about it, but you were smuggling in religious books for...
Yes, of course.
..the Jewish community
of
who
course,
couldn't obtain them.
You see, we were approached by people who had relatives there, and they were not in touch with them. They knew they were there, they were hardly in touch with them. So we used to take letters. Of course, you do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes. It wasn't terribly easy, because they were very fierce then. I took matzahs, I took letters, of course. We went to the outskirts of Moscow to deliver these letters.
You smuggled out someone's violin.
Oh, that was very interesting. Yes, that was Panofnik. Panofnik's father was a very well-known violin maker in Warsaw, And all the violins had been lost, all gone up in flames, except one violin that Oistra had. And so when I went home to Oistra, as we always did when we were there, he said, just a moment, and he climbed up to the top of a big cupboard, brought down this violin, and there was a little bit of arrangement made in I'd taken over an old violin. I mean, I discussed this.
You'd swapped, yes.
I took over a very old and battered violin and changed it to Panofnik's violin, which I brought for André. And, of course, this for him was one of the great events of his life, when he got his father's violin back again.
And then the breach with the Russians. Mm. The Iron Curtain came down on you. What happened?
Well, 1974, they were very unhappy with us because of Rostropovich.
Whom they had thrown out and was now living with
you. Yes, he was there living with us. They also knew that we were very closely concerned with Israel. They must have known that because we didn't hide it at all. And generally speaking, they felt it must be time to cut off relations. And it was like that, immediate. Actually, it was very hard for us because these people we were so closely involved with all the people there, with all the artists, from the emotional point of view, basically. Of course, it was also wonderful, wonderful business, as it were. I have to admit, we had to keep our head above water somehow.
How did it end?
Well, how did it end? Oistrakh died in Amsterdam at the end of 1974, and Tamara, his wife, telephoned me. She had no one to help her. So I dashed over to Amsterdam to make arrangements for her. Without a coat, without anything, I just got onto a plane, went to Amsterdam, helped her arrange for his body to be taken back to, for some reason there was no one else there to help her. And she said, you must come with me. I said, well, I can't because I haven't even got a coat with me or anything. I'll come. When I got back, they refused to give me a visa to go to David Oistrakh's funeral. I was devastated. I could not, they would not let me go back to his funeral. And that was the first intimation. We had no idea that this was going to happen. So everything was cut off like that. It came to a standstill, and it was 12 years before anyone came back.
And it must have been devastating for your business. Everything stopping just like that.
We had Nureyev in the wings.
Yes.
And we also were dealing with the Chinese. We brought an enormous amount of culture from China.
In the 70s?
In 73, we started phoning the Chinese embassy. We were quite interested in their acrobats. That would be interesting, we thought. But we couldn't get them to answer the phone, so we didn't quite know how to go about it. We had a great friend who died just recently called John Morgan in the Foreign Office. And he was in charge of the Chinese desk, as it were. And we said, what should we do? Well, he arranged a meeting with the Chinese in the Foreign Office. Slowly, slowly, we arranged to bring the first visit of the Chinese acrobats to London, which was a success that is impossible to describe. Then we brought, of course, Peking opera, we brought wushu, we brought martial arts, we brought everything possible. And in fact, I also took the BBC Symphony Orchestra to China, and also took to China, which was then the London Festival Ballet, with the orchestra, which for a tour in China, which was the first ballet company after the Cultural Revolution. There hadn't been anyone there for 18 years. I remember very clearly, I met the orchestras there. They were in a terrible state. The leader of the orchestra had been working in the fields for 11 years. He'd just come back. They had, when we took the BBC Symphony Orchestra there, which was, I presume it was in the late 60s, early 70s, we then met poor musicians. They were shattered and battered, and they had no instruments. So when we got back to London, we sent them crates of music. They had no music. They had absolutely no music. They had been really broken. This Cultural Revolution, as you know, that anyone connected with so-called with culture was beaten and bruised, and Foodsong's parents committed suicide, and all sorts of terrible things happened there. This was the beginning of things a little bit better, you know?
Mm.
And we worked. So so we were never really short of work, as it were. And then, of course, Rudolph came along. He was in his own way a genius. He was the greatest, greatest dancer. And for 12 years, we bought, I think it was over 30 companies from all over the world to appear in the summer seasons, which we called Nureyev Festivals. And he would dance every night, sometimes for 7 weeks.
Was that at Covent Garden?
No, that was always at the Coliseum.
Coliseum.
In those days, you couldn't get Covent Garden. Nobody went to Covent Garden because the place was so ramshackle that they needed all the time to tidy it up and repair it. So nobody could ever have a summer season there. The moment it was available, yes, and we've been there ever since. So Rudolph, until he became ill.
Very flamboyant man.
Well, more than flamboyant. He was a very difficult person. He was such a great artist. He was so magnificent.
How did his difficulty express itself with you?
Well, he was very impatient. Mm-hmm. His English was terrible. And he never had any time. So if I wanted to arrange a season with him, he was either practicing at the bar in his English, which I couldn't understand, or not, you know, or partly in Russian, partly in bad English and so on. And he'd get very impatient, you see. But again, it was one of those things that, in the end, proved really worth it.
And then with the end of the Soviet Union, you start up again in Russia, and you're bringing
over... Well, Perestroika
came
along in 91.
Yeah.
And I thought, Richter, where are you? Actually, Richter I knew where he was because I never lost touch with him. I used to go to his concerts everywhere. He never came back for 16 years. He wouldn't come back and appear for anybody else. In 91, I went back to Russia to get Richter again. My dream to get him back again, which I did. And at the same time, I thought, why not try the Kirov and the Bolshoi again. But things were very strange there. There was a lot of hanky-panky going on in the Kirov. In the Kirov especially, there was a great fall going on at the time. But anyway, it did get sorted out, and we did get them back again. And now we are very closely involved with them. And Valery Gergiev as well.
But like Furtseva, like Hrennikov, not an easy person to deal with.
He is not an easy, but he's very charming.
Mm-hmm.
He's very, very nice, and he's very charmed, and he is enormously talented, but very difficult. I mean, he knows it himself. He's very difficult. But, of course,
the difference was, when the Soviets were around, you were able to say to them, look, we are putting on this programme, we're financing it, therefore we're going to say what's going to be in it. But with Gergiev, you can't do that. Gergiev is telling you what he wants to put on in London. No?
Well, we have a few fights now and then.
So I hear.
About it, yes. About what each of us want to do. But we are very great friends, actually. I mean, even in the old days, one had to find a way of dealing with working with the artists and not treating them like pieces of furniture to be pushed around and human beings. And what we used to do, of course, in the case of all these great artists, we used to have our discussions outside Russia about the programmes and what we should play. And then we would allow Gosconcert to suggest these programmes, you see. But we had already agreed them beforehand. So we found a way.
Okay. It gives a whole new dimension to cultural diplomacy.
Exactly. I could give lessons in that.
So now you stage an occupation of the Royal Opera House every summer.
Yes.
Huge financial undertaking on your part.
Yes, it is.
With your reputation and your business on the line. And there's quite a bit of jealousy from the subsidised companies. How do you make it pay when others don't?
Well, we work with a very small staff. It is becoming very difficult now because hotels are phenomenally expensive, and we sometimes have to bring 400 people here. Not only that, but visas, for instance. Now, where visas were always free, visas now cost £150 each. Each person costs £150. And so it's, and the auditorium doesn't grow, unfortunately. It's still 2,000, you know. And there's a limit to the amount of money you can ask
for. So you have to charge high prices?
We have to charge. There's no other way. I mean, and then the risk is big. And you can't bring them just doing Swan Lake, as you can imagine, although I wouldn't mind sometimes. So you have to balance it with works which are new, which you're not sure if the public will come. It's a big balancing act.
You're in your 80s.
Oh, well into there, yes.
Your grandchildren's idea of having a good time with you is seeing you in the interval of a ballet.
Well, yes, they love it. It's wonderful. They can go to rehearsals. Even my great-grandchildren go to the rehearsals too, yes.
Why do you keep doing it? What pushes you on?
Well, why not? I mean, it's interesting. It's living. It's culture and it's life.